Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. I hope you're listening to Maltin on Movies. I hope you didn't just...
We're sending it out in smoke signals.
Yes,
that's what it is. Little puffs with an M.
But you'll be glad you listened today because our guest is the wonderful Giancarlo Esposito. And welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure to be here with both of you.
And gosh, I've been watching you so long.
I know.
And enjoying your work.
You're one of my favorite humans is your publicist over here, Jeffrey Chazen. And when he offered you up as tribute to us, when he said you,
yes, that does sound funny. Offered you up.
We were sitting having dinner. And I said to my dad, oh, my God, Jeffrey. Jeffrey's asking if we want to have Giancarlo Esposito. My dad goes, well, yeah. Yeah, we do. So very, very excited you're here with us.
It's an honor. It truly is.
You have been performing pretty much your whole life.
Pretty much my whole life. I started on stage in New York on Broadway with a show called Maggie Flynn, which is my first Broadway production directed by Morton DaCosta. Hmm. And when I got this show, I was 7.5, 8 years old.
Oh, my God.
And it's really, really an interesting time for the musicals on Broadway at that time. And
what do you take away from, what do you remember from that experience?
Gosh, I remember Shirley Jones being so wonderful and so marvelous to all of us nine kids who played slaves. Mm-hmm. I remember Stephanie Mills before she was ever Stephanie Mills. Mm-hmm. I remember big Robert Lindsay, who no one knows who he is, a big, big, big boy who had the most gorgeous voice. It was an incredible show, and it was really wonderful to work with folks who were so seasoned.
Yeah.
It was just a very different experience for me.
Morton DaCosta directed The Music Man, Auntie Mame. I mean,
he was an absolute legend. Yeah, really, really a fabulous, fabulous human being, I must say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a great piece of work.
Good start.
Yes, not bad.
And you were telling us just before we started recording that your most recent Broadway experience was equally amazing.
Equally amazing. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, directed by Debbie Allen, who refused to change a word of the script and wanted to honor Tennessee Williams and prove that this particular play could not only stand the test of time, which it has over the years, but also could stand the test of color. Mm-hmm. And so we had an all-black cast, James Earl Jones, Terrence Howard, Anika Noni Rose, myself, Felicia Rashad, and had a beautiful and marvelous time doing this play and not changing it one bit because of the color of our skin.
Wowie. I guess mendacity is a word that just translates.
Yes, absolutely. It just translates. It really does. And, it's a very particular play written in a very particular era. Mm-hmm. And so you could look at the writer and say, how is he affected by the time period in which he lived mm-hmm. and by what was going on racially at that time? Mm-hmm. And so we looked at things up and heard all kinds of stories about, look, Tennessee Williams, the master playwright, certainly used the word nigger mm-hmm. and other derogatory terms for African Americans. And so it was an honoring and for me and a real forgiveness of folks who grew up at that time, who were a part of what was happening in general for
yeah.
people then.
Yeah.
I hold nothing against him at all. I think he's a most incredible playwright, and it was wonderful to serve his piece up.
Yeah.
But see, you're compassionate and you're aware, and so you're not coming at it from a judgmental standpoint. And that's so important, because if you walk in going, how dare he use the N-word? You know, how could you do such a thing? It's it changes everything.
It does. I would agree. I think part of our outlook is formed by who we have been, mm-hmm. and then it gets continued by who we are now,
yeah.
and then it gets even further by who we'd like to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have yeah. you met Dee Reese at all?
No, I have not.
So she's the director of Mudbound, which is getting attention.
Oh,
right
yes,
now.
I have met her.
She's fantastic.
Fabulous.
And we got to interview her, which was so – she's just an incredible woman. An absolutely incredible woman.
And young.
Very young.
Well,
please.
Her first movie, Pariah, absolutely blew
incredible.
Me away.
Amazing film.
Yeah. But
so she was talking to us about, in Mudbound, getting the white actors comfortable with saying words that you don't say. And she talked about how she worked on that. And I've shared that with so many friends, saying that that's exactly what you have to do.
That's right.
So that when Jason Clark has to say the N-word to especially to a black person,
right,
not just use it in a scene in a moment, but to actually look at someone and say, listen, N-word, you know. And she talked about how she figured that out by having them sit there going, chair, floor, table, N-word, blah, 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 to try and get the same sort of, like, it's just a word. It has no meaning.
It's so perfect. You know, when I grew up, if someone called you, you know, the N-word, it was the ultimate offense.
Yeah.
And so it'll give you an idea of how old I am. And then as I...
I'm right there with you, buddy.
As I got older, as I got older and you go to the neighborhood, yo, you my nigga. One black person to another.
Right.
And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Now that whole thing has changed. Yo, nigga, yeah. Come here. Like, so black people could call each other niggas, but white people could call them niggas. And I was like, oh, this is a new age. And then it became a term of endearment in the African-American community.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And so it's interesting that there is a power in words, and certainly the inflection and the thought and the intention behind them is what's most important.
Yeah.
I say ninja. And the reason I say ninja is when I am singing along to rap songs, which happens frequently, that is what I will say. And my friends think it's the funniest thing they've ever heard. So I've now got quite a large circle of all the color friends, every kind of color that exists, who says ninja. Because I just find it really amusing that's what I'm going to say. I'm not going to say the other one.
I like it.
It's not coming out.
I like
it. So, you know, when me and Kanye... are in the car together. That's what I'm. That's what I, and me and Jay-Z, we're just ninja-ing.
This is in the future.
Yeah.
This is in the prospective future.
Like,
oh.
Yeah.
Yo, that's my ninja.
That's exactly it. See, it works.
It works. Perfectly.
And no one's
sounds
offended.
Good coming from you too.
No one's offended. They're just amused. And that is the goal in life, is just to make people laugh.
Truly love it.
Now, the first time I remember seeing you and you making a real impression on me was in Do the Right Thing. Which I imagine you made an impression on a lot of people in that movie.
Yeah.
It's a showcase for you, a great part, most extraordinary dialogue and situations. But as I was checking your credits last night, I said, but he did a lot of stuff before Spike
right.
Lee came along.
I sure did. Although blessed to have met Spike, and I was doing a play at the Negro Ensemble Company called Zoom Man and the Sign. I had just won the Obie Award and the Theater World Award for that play. And Spike was cleaning films, Maxie Cohen's first run features. And he came to see the play, and he waited. And he just pushed his way backstage and says, I got to talk to you. I'm making this movie called School Days, and you got to do this with me. And so it was a very interesting period of time in my life. To be able to talk to him about this musical of School Days, which came before Do the Right Thing.
Well, you're reminding me of that. Yes.
And he then showed me his first film, Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop.
Oh, yes, indeed.
We Cut Heads.
Yeah.
And I thought, this guy's talented. And so I came on board for School Days and then moved on to the bigger film and more provocative film, Do the Right Thing. And it was just an amazing experience to take a block in Brooklyn, clean it up of the crack houses, clean it up of all the homeless people, and turn it into a film set. So it felt very real and very organic. And of course, Spike wrote it in such a very beautiful way. Time of Tawana Brawley, when Al Sharpton was a bigger man, and you know, he chased everything there was to chase surrounding race consciousness in New York. It's a very particular time in New York, and I'm really happy that I had a chance to have that showcase. Because my energy fit with the film so much. Mm-hmm. My father was worried. You know, I'm half African-American, mother born in Alabama, half Italian. Mm-hmm. My father is Giovanni Esposito.
My favorite thing to read.
So wait a minute. So if I call you Paisan, it's okay.
You're
it's
right.
fine.
Call me
okay,
Paisan.
Good.
It's good.
IMDb is not always right, but there are things that just crack me up every now and then. You go to look an actor up, and the very first thing that before clicking, just looking at you, Giancarlo Giuseppe Alessandro Esposito was born in Copenhagen, Denmark, to an Italian carpenter / stagehand father from Naples and an opera singing African American mother from Alabama.
There we go. Wow.
I mean, you won the jackpot, man.
I did. I really did. Spike taught me a lot, and my father He did not like Do the Right Thing because he thought there were too many curse words, and it was at a time in his life where he was teaching school.
Uh-huh.
But it was the perfect movie for me to come into my own, because at that time, Spike was completely pro-black. He didn't want to hear nothing about white people, no white people on the set. And I would always have conversations with him about, you know, some of that anger that needed to subside in him and see people as who they really were.
Yeah.
But it taught me to find my own way. And that was the film where I went, well, you know, I knew a lot about Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, who was one of my idols in the African-American community. But I wanted to be a person, an individual, and not a color. I didn't want to, you know, go through my life carrying, in the Louis Bunuel movies, which you would know, that sack, the guy who crosses through the back of the frame with a big, huge sack of crap, but it's all his own. I always refer to that because I didn't want to carry that bag all of my life, and it wasn't my place. And thankfully for Spike, he is able to be the voice and champion in that arena. And I love it because he's brought consciousness. He's raised consciousness through his film work and also through his political work. But I knew that wasn't me. I needed to just be able to respect humans for who they are, no matter what color they are. And that film started it all for me because, you know, we all became like Spike. We were all pro-black. We were all like, yeah. You know, it was very, very passionate and energetic and very much of a family. But in the end, I do remember that some folks who work with Spike who were in interracial marriages broke up. And, you know, they were affected so deeply by that, you know, pro-black
Jesse,
movement.
It was too young to have experienced that at that time, that film, and what it reflected at that time, and how frightened people were that it was going to come out at the beginning of summer in New York City.
That's right.
You remember that?
That's right.
There was real fear.
Giancarlo, you know, he called, hey, they say they're going to be rioting in the theater. This is Spike calling me. Yo, Giancarlo, they're going to riot in the theater. I mean, wait, is that crazy? And so he called me right away. The press was all over him. This is going to create riots and race wars and all of this stuff. And instead, it lifted our consciousness and allowed us to be a little more understanding of each other for who we are.
And interesting, I found it interesting, too. I mean, there are several really good Caucasian actors in that movie, John Savage and Danny Aiello, and of course John Turturro, who became part of Spike's repertory company.
He's done more movies with Spike than I have. When I call Spike now, I'm like, yo, what's up with Turturro, man? What do I mean? John is a brilliant actor, and he and Spike are very, very close, and and Danny Aiello, of course, was wonderful in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, I pray and hope that Spike realizes how much he's done for all people, not just for African Americans.
Yeah.
I want to tip my hat to him for that, because he has really changed our lives in so many ways and continues to remind us how to be better human beings in that way.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about some of your earliest movie experiences, because the first film I think you're in is Trading Places.
That's an early feature film. That's right. That's one of the first ones where I had at least a couple of lines. And,
a big deal.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal when you're not just carrying a sack across the back of it, you know, and you actually get to say something like coffee or tea.
It's
exciting.
And Eddie Murphy was red hot.
So young, red hot, really affable, really a pleasure to work with. Mm-hmm. And that jail scene, to me, people play it back to me all these years later. And I look at it and I go, well, I guess that's where I first learned how to steal a scene. Because I'm in the background. And he's going, tell us how you cut the dude. And I'm doing all this with my hands.
Chewing the scenery.
And I look at it now and I go, part of me hates it. I'm going, oh, my gosh. And then the other part of me goes, oh, my God, but I was so thin and so beautiful. But I had a great time on that film, and it was lovely to see how loose Eddie was.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie was completely loose, completely in his everything was in his field of vision, and he was able to be so spontaneous. And I really enjoyed the short time I was on that set with him.
When your first experiences are good.
Yeah.
Because so many people, you know, the stories vary, They always will. And you don't know what you're going to deal with egos or anything else. So it's nice that gets to be something precious for you.
Absolutely.
And it's not that kind of like, I mean, I put up with it and it was my first film, but it was a learning experience, I guess. It gets to be something really good.
That's right.
It's nice.
It's nice when you make it a good experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. Mm-hmm.
And then you have to pay close attention, but you're in John Sayles' Brother from Another Planet.
Oh, my goodness. You pulled that out of me. He's one of my favorite writers.
Me too.
I really loved him. I really was willing to be an extra on that film. Dear friend and great actor, Joe Morton.
Oh, indeed.
In that leading role. And what was I doing? I was stealing some hubcaps and running across the street. I think that's one where I never even said a word.
Yeah.
But was so interested in being there because of the talent that was going to be on the set.
And Ernest Dickerson was shooting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John is just a fabulous writer and director. I love his films. And you know what else I love about him? I love that he keeps it small. Mm-hmm. He keeps it small, mm-hmm. so he's able to really portray in his films what he really feels.
Yeah, he wants it to be his film.
That's right.
So by keeping it small, he can keep it his film.
That's right. That's right.
And then there's one that wasn't so small, The Cotton Club.
Yes.
Now, tell us about that. This is another film that, in fact, Francis Coppola has just edited his, like, director's cut of the movie. It debuted at Telluride this past September,
really?
And I didn't get to see it. So I'm really curious, because apparently it has substantial differences from the one that was released. And now that's piqued my curiosity.
I'm very curious to see that. You know, working with Francis at that time, at probably his height, was a serious experience, because mm-hmm. he did what he wanted to do. And at that period of time, it was really before video got really big and cable got really big. And I remember when I was in college, I did some work off a cable truck, shot all of the Iona basketball games, and we used to pull the cable from a little van into the room. Well, Francis was doing that years before. Mm-hmm. He was experimenting with green screen years before, and on Cotton Club was my first experience with that. Mm-hmm. Walking into an empty studio, and Francis says, okay, put the chair and the table wherever you want them. You put some tape on the floor. And it was the oddest thing to work with furniture that was not there that he was going to add in later. It was like play. Mm. Francis was like a little boy and a brilliant one at that. Yeah. So we had a very long shoot. And part of that length probably got transferred to our long lunches. Hey, Coppola, Esposito, very Italian.
Yes.
3-hour lunches, tablecloth, silver.
I was just
going to
say, I know this about him. He eats well.
Wine. I mean, you had enough time to eat and take a nap afterward. I love the way this man made film. Hmm. Really wonderful. I really that period of time for me. Solidified some really wonderful relationships that I carried for most of my life. One with Gregory Hines.
Oh, God bless him.
Angel.
One of my favorite people. And we worked together all the way, almost to the end. I did a piece with him for Joy to Learn, a learning piece directly from the computer into the school system. And he was already ill, and he said, I got to do this for you because this is a wonderful program to allow young people to know about tap dancing. So we did the history of tap dancing. They could click anywhere and learn about the shoes and learn about Gregory's life and learn about steps and movement and all this. And so that all came from Cotton Club. Another great actor, Larry Marshall, who is just, you know, known on Broadway, an incredible singer, dancer. So many great, talented people were on that show. But I learned something else, and I think I first learned it with Francis. Francis is an artist. He has the visionary eye of an artist. And as a director, to have that visionary eye of an artist, because everything that was created, I think it was Milena Colnero, who did the costumes, that was all her and Francis figuring out what the color schemes were. And when I became a director, I started to realize you've got to think about what is your color palette for your film. I learned that from Francis. Mm-hmm. It's just an incredible experience. It's a full and complete way of working. And I feel blessed to have worked with such a visionary.
Wow.
He wears hot pink polka dot socks that don't match. And he specifically said, when I commented on the socks, he said, I never match my socks. Who would do such a thing? And I just said, I don't. Who? What are you? Like, what magical planet did you come from, you crazy, crazy man?
He is. And I know you also know, more than likely, that his son, who is no longer with us, Giancarlo, my namesake, and we used to call him Gio. Shot much of the second unit footage that's in the original film. It's so beautiful as well.
Wow.
Family business.
Now,
family
business. You're in a film that nobody seems to know, that is, last time I checked, isn't available in any
anywhere.
Medium. But my wife and I saw it when it was new, 30 years ago, Sweet Lorraine. It is just a lovely, lovely film about life at a small, maybe failing Catskills resort, presided over by Maureen Stapleton, yeah. the late, great Maureen Stapleton, yes. and Lee Richardson yes. in the kitchen. And it's got a wonderful cast, you among them.
Thank you.
And it just has such a perfect feel for that time, place, ethos, atmosphere, yes. all of that stuff. And when I saw Dirty Dancing, which came out just a little while later, they had so sanitized. They
my mom always says they got rid of all the Jews. She says, whenever she watches Dirty Dancing, she goes, where'd all the Jews go? What happened? What's going on? It's like God. It's like Jerry Orbach's got to carry it for everybody.
Yeah.
Just.
I said, no, go see Sweet Lorraine. You want to see yeah. what it's like.
But that's part of why it's so special. But my mom worked in the Catskills when she was young and all that. So
she was
that
a counselor,
movie for her.
Her brother was a waiter in the
yeah.
Catskills. So.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I love that movie for that reason. I had gone to the Catskills as well. To go to the City Yoga Dham up there, which mm-hmm. is right in the middle of all that now. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, it was Bhagawan Muktananda who started that, brought that meditation over. But so I wound up going up there a lot and seeing all of the closed resorts that were
yeah.
up there
yeah.
and the ones that were still trying to survive. And so I knew a little bit about the area. And when I got a call to audition for Steve Gomer, who directed that, and I believe Trini Alvarado starred
yep.
in the movie,
yep.
I was really, really excited because I had also been a waiter for a number of years. So, and I could carry a tray stacked so high.
Ooh.
And I thought, wow, this will be an experience that'll tie my life together.
Mm.
And so sometimes work comes along, and it was an early film, anything then with film. I had been a theater actor for so long and done so many dramas and plays and musicals on Broadway that I wanted to move into a new venue with film.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that was going to be done on film, I was eager to do. But I also look for things that sort of remind me of my life that I've lived.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of solidify in a way that either lets go of something that I've done, because mm-hmm. I don't know if I'd ever return. I remember working at a place on Columbus Avenue, and Chita Rivera used to come in, and Bob Fosse used to come in, and I would serve them, and they would fall in love with me. So whenever they came in, they wanted my section. They finally would ask me, who are you? I said, I'm a song and dance man, Bob. I'm a song and dance man, Bob.
did you know the Running Footman at all?
No.
It's okay. a different.
Yeah. That's where my mom worked and had.
Totally
I feel like you
place.
And my mother would probably have some very interesting conversations.
More than likely.
She's a little bit older than you. And she worked the Running Footman and the same kind of thing. These people would come in and she just plotzed. Plotzed is the word.
Yeah.
She, you know,
yeah.
In person.
It's lovely when that happens. Sweet Lorraine was a special experience yeah. that, and it is a very, very sweet and wonderful
that
movie.
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
You have to forgive me, but I can't recall what you did in Desperately Seeking Susan.
Oh, my goodness. So it was the first time I met Madonna,
mm-hmm.
and I was selling sunglasses and hats on the street. My hair was dreadlock. You wouldn't recognize me. And she comes up, and I try to sell her some glasses.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't want to buy them, so I'm irate. Like, come back. You got to buy these. It was a really wonderful scene, and it was back when Madonna, before Madonna was
Madonna. Yeah.
And
that was one of the films that helped establish her.
It really did. Yeah. And a very good film as well.
Yeah.
I like the movie. I wish I was in it longer, but the real icing on the cake for me was it was a low budget film and
mm-hmm.
they only had one trailer, and so they split it in half and I was sharing it with Madonna. Yes, can you believe that?
There's a credential.
There's a credential, man. So every time that little louver door would open, I would go, are you peeking on me or am I peeking on you?
Oh, hello, Madonna.
Well, you know, and then
you could have given her some acting tips, you know.
Introduce
you yourself helped
as
her out.
Louise, and that's how I know her.
Yeah.
Like when I see her today, it just comes out. Hi, Louise. I don't even think Madonna.
Yeah.
I think Louise, because that's how long I've known
yeah.
her. It's really kind of lovely.
Hmm.
The thing... We always talk about this is the 20-year overnight success. You've been working since and you're eight, you know, you've been working since you were a kid. But yes, this is breakthrough, brand new. And so seeing it, seeing Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and stuff like that. And my dad was saying he watched an interview with you where you said you've become aware that you are now known globally because of these both shows really that are – so wildly popular.
Absolutely.
And they've become, anywhere you are in the world, they're playing. I cannot tell you how many really, really strange voice-overed versions of the show I've seen at this point in God knows where, in the Czech Republic, where you're going, ¿qué? Like, what are you even saying? And to work as long as you have and to be a working actor. And a working actor, they are the ones who keep the entire industry going.
I would hope so. I remember a time where I just wanted to be a star. Maybe it was because of the star money, and maybe it was because I wanted more recognition. And then I sat myself down and said, Giancarlo, all you have to do is love what you do. Mm-hmm. And that's really the most important thing. And I'm still passionate and in love completely with what I do. I go to great lengths to create characters, and certainly Gustavo was a great success because of the writing and because of the family and the brilliance of Vince Gilligan and his writing team.
Sure.
But also, you know, Vince says to me he will not take any other word but you made our show.
Wow.
That's what he says to me. And that's a great, great honor. But it was because I was open to making some decisions that were different and that were a little bit bold. And I wanted this guy to be a nice guy. And I didn't want him to be the typical, stereotypical bad guy.
It's too easy.
It's much too easy.
Too easy to be a bad
and
guy.
And I found, you know, I call that Breaking Bad my third rise to stardom. You mentioned it earlier. You know, so
it's
when
true. I mean, it is.
It just comes in waves.
It is.
And I take it in a different way now because I feel so blessed to not have to have it go to my head. I'm very aware as I travel through Europe and China and Asia and Seoul, Korea, where I was just there in June for the Okja premiere, work with Bong Joon-ho.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But, you know, I'm very aware how well I'm known, and it tickles me now. I'm not afraid of it. I don't get aggravated when people want selfies, which is 24/7. It really, it's a way of sharing your love and sharing my delight that I'm still here and that I still have this deep love. I'm not aggravated by anything that I do. I'm always looking for that new experience that will grow me in a different way.
I think that does come with being a theater person. I really do, because every time you're on stage, it's exciting. Every single show, it's exciting.
That's right.
And it's a new audience, and my dad got to interview Stubby K.
Ugh.
While he was doing, in was it in London?
No, it was here. He moved to London. That's why he was in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But he came back to Broadway because Harold Prince directed a show called Grind.
Who I worked with, too.
Of course you did.
I feel like there isn't anyone you haven't worked with.
Well, there are a few. I have a hit list. But tell me, Grind. I remember this.
Well,
okay.
What I said, this is going off on a little bit of a tangent, but I was so thrilled to meet Stubby K. This was, you know, Nicely Johnson.
My personal Lord and Savior, Stubby K. I love that
Marion Sam from Little Abner. It was just, you know, and there he was, delightful man. And he did Guys and Dolls for something like 2.5 years. He was in the original New York company forever, did the National Road Tour, and then did the London production.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I said, how do you stay fresh so that when you go out for your
It was something like 1,400 performances. You know, it was something crazy,
you know,
like that.
You're still giving it, you know.
You're all.
He looked at me puzzled. He looked at me. He said, the guy is paying, you know, $50 a ticket, you know, for the 500th performance. Deserves the same good effort you put in opening night.
That's right.
Yeah.
As if to say, what else?
Yeah.
How else would you approach this? That was his professionalism.
And whenever I hear young people bitch, that's the first thing I say, is that this is, not only are we lucky that we're in this crazy industry, but when you're a performer and you're a stage performer,
it's in you.
It's there.
I'm telling you, every single night, I could do 8 shows a week, and
right?
it's fresh and new every single time, and I still get the butterflies, and I still get nervous. Even before the camera rolls now, people say, are you not nervous anymore? I said, I am, because I realize some nervousness is great expectation,
mm-hmm.
and that allows me to be present mm-hmm. and give my all.
You care.
I care a lot.
You care.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, and to me, every time we meet people who have done, whether they started in theater or found theater at some point, I swear, it's a magic that, there's no other thing to me that can give you quite what that gives you. No. And it's a high, it's a drug, it's whatever you want to look at it as. Mm-hmm. It's just something really, really special.
And it's a test, too. Can you stay cool in front of 1,500 people who are on the at the edge of their, hopefully will be on the edge of their seats?
Mm-hmm.
Can you keep your cool and get around your ego, get around your nerves, get around your doubt of who you are, and deliver?
Yeah.
And, you know, when you finish that number or you finish that scene and people are just in awe and they're clapping, you realize, I got them. I got them.
Yeah.
The play has got them.
Yeah.
The musical has got them. They're with us. Mm. And I was always told, you're either on the train or off the train. And you can have that in a two-hour performance of a play or a musical. You could have fallen off the train, but the important thing is that you get back on.
Mm.
Now, how do you give yourself that same stimulus when you're working on a television or a movie set?
Like a 17-hour
day. There is no immediacy. There is no audience response.
I create a spontaneity for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I try to come very well prepared so I know what the lines are. And television today, it's and I've worked on shows where it is about the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I, when I was younger and the writing wasn't so great in certain scenes, I would just change it. And I'd go to the director and say, I'm going to say this. And I did that once with Spike Lee. And he was like, wait, cut. Who said that? I was like, what? Who said that? And I went, I did. There was this long pause, and we were on the quad doing a scene from School Days, and he said, great, say it again. And so I won that time. But certainly not something I do all the time. Yeah. And in Breaking Bad and also with Saul, we have very specific moments, and Gus is so very specific. I create a space.
Mm-hmm.
What I can control with great, great writing is the rhythm. I cannot speak when I'm expected to speak and take a little extra time. I can completely control how quickly I answer a question, and then I can use my emotions to give looks to people where that aren't written in the script.
Mm-hmm.
And that has always worked for me in a very successful way without slowing down the scene,
mm-hmm.
but allowing space because my character would do that. So I figure out with each film or television piece, I give myself something to work on. One thing. I don't want to multitask. What am I going to work on? With Gus, I want it to be completely calm. I want it to be more observant of someone's behavior than creating behavior of my own. And that sometimes gets a little scary when someone is really observing you completely, because we don't practice that anymore. Really looking in someone's eyes,
mm-hmm.
really seeing all of who they are. And that worked for me successfully with Gus. So I find different ways to keep it fresh and alive, mm-hmm. even on a 17-hour day,
mm-hmm.
that allows me to play within the lines, to play within the emotion. There's an awareness that has to be there for an actor to be able to do that.
And you've proven yourself. I mean, you've done guest shots on so many episodic TV shows over the years, over the decades, some just once, some short-run shows, some longer-run shows.
20 episodes, 30 episodes, 40 episodes. And then, of course, like all working actors, then there's that 1-1-1 for the 17 Law & Orders and the 32 CSIs. You know, it's a wild thing to look at these as is. You have one hell of a filmography, you know? It ain't short. And seeing all these different pieces, again, I find it so exciting, because it's like you get to play. You get to come in for a day and do whatever the hell it is, and then you get to go do something else.
I really believe this is the way it should be in our lives. You know, I say, you know, many people say, I got to go to work. And I realize how important words are and how you frame that. And I say, I have to go to play. I mean, they're both four-letter words, W-O-R-K-P-L-A-Y, but I want to play in my life and enjoy it, and I've had the opportunity to do that. I've lived so many lives within my career, which has been sort of fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, doctors, lawyers, drug addicts, you know, police.
Muhammad Ali's father.
Are you even old enough to be Will Smith's dad? I feel like you're not. When you said that, I know you don't crack, but still.
Oh, like, you're so kind.
Like, are you old? I don't think you are.
I actually am, and I do love Will. I mean, you have to also take into consideration that before your time and years ago, we had children at a younger age.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
still, no, it's a, that was a, it's one of those funny ones when you find out an actor's like 3 years older and they're playing the great aunt or the grandmother. Yes. And that's how I felt seeing that particular credit for you. I went, brother, maybe? But.
Yeah, it was a favorite of mine. I had met Muhammad Ali when I was 10 years old, across from the Winter Garden Theater where I was doing Maggie Flynn, at the office building on the diagonal corner. Uh-huh. He had protested the draft. He had walked out of this building, and my mother came to pick us up and went, "What's going on over there?" And she said, "That's Muhammad Ali." And he was such an idol and an icon for me then. And he said, "Hey, young man," and he shook my hand. I would have never imagined in all of my years that I would then again meet him on the set, that I'd be playing his father to another act. I just never, ever imagined
that. Oh, you say
that.
Full circle.
Yeah, really completes my life in such a beautiful and grand way, you know. You know, another idol of mine I saw two years ago at the Emmys was Sidney Poitier. Mm-hmm. And I was so starstruck that I thought, I can't say anything to him. It was at an Emmy party, and I could see he was getting ready to leave. And I think he was with Diana Shimkus, his wife, and he was my idol.
Joanna.
And he was my idol for another reason, because he didn't carry his color. He carried his dignity as a man. And that taught me so much in my life and my career. And I stopped him. And I said these exact words to him. I said, "You taught me dignity. You taught me how to respect myself as a human being, no matter what color I am. You taught me how to be human." I watched him from the time I was a little boy, and I thought, I want to have that in my being. Forget being an actor. I want to have that in my consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so would you believe that he turned around, we have arms are linked, he looks me right in the eye, and he says, "I feel you and thank you, and you're a wonderful actor. I followed your career," and someone took a picture, and I have that picture
all
on
right.
my wall.
Great.
To remind me.
You made me cry. That's, I mean, it's... I think he's the most beautiful person I've ever seen.
Oh, my goodness.
I think he actually might be the most beautiful person I've ever seen. Well,
it comes from within.
We've been really lucky, and we've got to be around him quite a bit,
through
the years. And every time I see him, every single time, I can't speak. And he doesn't even... What you're talking about is so deep, and I'm just looking at him as a fan. I'm not an actor. I'm looking at him as a fan and just as someone who I've watched forever and is so incredible. But so whenever we see him, it's kind of that thing, and he's, you know, big, beautiful smile, and he'll look over at you, and it's like no matter how old he gets, and that's the thing. He's someone where with age, he just stays that beautiful.
He really does. I came from an interracial marriage, of course, as you know, and it wasn't well received back in the 50s. And I can remember all the fights with cab drivers my mother and father had, or different people who gave them attitude, or even the women in the church who said, "Oh, man, you got that good hair. Look at them curls. Oh, that's so cute. You got that good hair." You know, Spike's whole, you know, part of School Days was about, you know, the wannabes and the folks with the good hair and the blacks with the nappy hair, straight nappies. I still have those statues that I got from that particular movie. So there's always been something about film that for me in that time of Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, in that period of time, that taught me about the world, but also taught me how to be a man. And film has such a beautiful way in that period of time of weaving together the stories of our lives, whether they be controversial, whether they be passionately loving. But this was my world where I could escape and learn more about who I envisioned myself to be.
Wow. What could be more powerful than that?
Mm-mm.
You know, truly. And yet, some of those films that I'm sure influenced you were not message movies or, you know, intentionally moralistic movies. They were just entertainment.
That's right.
But because of the power of the medium itself, sitting in the dark,
right?
Watching a movie larger than life, or on television, it works too, but in a movie theater, when you're in a crowd that's silent, hypnotized by that screen, that's a lifetime memory or a lifetime experience.
You know, I love the Thin Man series, and I love William Powell and Myrna Loy, and I can remember shaving my mustache down to that thin little mustache.
Pencil mustache? Wow.
Pencil mustache, slicking my hair back, and I'd look in the mirror, and I was William Powell. I thought he could be dramatic, he could be funny, everything else. And I love this film, The Best Years of Our Lives.
Oh, wow.
And the scene that Myrna Loy has with her daughter about her relationship to her husband and how her daughter says to her, it was easy for you. And she says, no, we had to recreate this over and over and over again. You just didn't see it. We had to replenish our relationship and recreate this and fall in love again. It brings tears to my eyes because it's a perfect scene to teach us, because her daughter's getting married and she's worried she's going to get bored with her husband and all these things. It teaches us how to renew our love for each other and see each other anew and refreshed all the time. I mean, those are the movies I grew up on. Yeah. And I really, people thought I was crazy. You know, I think I was channeling William Powell when I did Mo Better Blues, you know, when I played Left Hand Lacy. I just wanted to be partly William Powell and partly Lester Young.
Oh, well, that's
it's a good,
nice
it's a great combo, though, right?
That's you can't a hell go of a wrong. Combination. Whoa.
So, did you say to your
wait a
parents?
Minute. Wait a minute.
Oh, yeah, he's enjoying this. He's enjoying it too much.
I didn't think I'd hear Lester Young's name today, and that just you just lifted my spirits.
I like that.
Oh my goodness.
I like that.
We're oh, my simple goodness. People.
Now, all of these experiences you had, both as an actor and as a viewer, as a moviegoer yourself, a theater goer yourself, how did all that come out when you started directing? Because you've directed two feature films.
Yes.
And you, I'm sure, called in some favors, and because I saw the cast list of those films.
Sure did. Yeah, sure
these
did.
Are people that you came up with in some cases. And but talk about the experience of being behind the camera.
A very, very different experience, one that takes more work than I had ever imagined, because as my four daughters might say, you know, we go to a regular diner where the menu is mostly the same all over the world in any diner, and I'm always the last one to order. But as a director, that cannot be you. You have to.
You're writing the menu. It's all on you.
Very frightening place to be. But I find that we, in film, we work with a family of filmmakers, and I like to allow people to have all of their own opinions, and I also ask that everyone, every grip, every driver has read the script so that they know what we're all doing. Just, you know, we all want to know what we're doing. So please, everyone read. And that creates a space where people come and say, you know, that scene, what if you did this or did that? And I invite people to give me suggestions. And I allow them to know, okay, I am the director. So this is what my job is. And what I'm learning is how to make all the decisions. So some of your suggestions might be something that would work for the film and others may not be. And there may be two that I may work with at one time, but eventually I have to make these decisions. So don't feel, you know, bad about it. If I don't listen to you, I'll listen to your suggestion, but if I don't take it and actually put it in the movie, I love directing. I think it's film is a director's medium.
Sure.
And I have a whole list of directors who I obviously think are a cut above anyone else because they tell a story in a different way. We as actors, we love directors who cater to actors because actors love to act. But there are some directors who are painting a much larger canvas than any actor could ever fill. And it becomes about their vision of what something may be.
And you don't necessarily know it when you're doing it, do you?
You don't know it when you're doing it. And it's difficult because then when you see something, you realize it wasn't about you at all. It was about the creation of what this director's doing. And I have to give that director credit and understand that. Had I understood that before, it may have changed my view and some questions I may have posed to a director. So a director comes in, he says, okay, I want to move you over here and you move over there. And then when you say this move there, we haven't even read the scene yet. And I say, okay, wait, do you mind if we just stand here and read the scene? And because, good, okay, darling, good, we'll read the scene. Okay, read the scene. Okay, now, no, hold on a minute. Would you mind if we read the scene and then I could try to feel where my instincts may guide me within this room to where I want to go? And I would say, because that might be exactly where you want me. Who knows? So I can have my organic instinct. Well, it's the same thing with being a director who is conscious of actors, who is also organically drawn to and connected to the material. The guide is the material. The guide is not, you know, how I'm going to do some fancy shot. Many directors are like that. But the guide for me is to what's the best way to express the message and the words of the film, and combine that with the shots that I feel would best portray all that. So it's very different to make a film. My first film was Gospel Hill, a smaller film with a great cast that dealt with a civil rights leader who was slain many years ago and the guilt that goes on after his death and coming up to a celebration of his death. The last film I made is called The Show. Very different movie than the first.
I'll say.
An unflinching look at reality television. And a real...
At the most gruesome form of reality television.
The most gruesome form of reality television. I wanted it to be a wake-up call to all of us who watch without any... We don't discern. We just watch, like a train wreck. And that came out of a number of things. You know, I just feel as if we're people who just sort of eat up whatever's put in front of us, and we become a sensationalistic society from our reality television and movies that we sometimes see. And then I have a young daughter who lives with me in particular in Austin, Texas, who looked on the computer and she saw something she shouldn't have. She scared herself. And I had to explain to her, you're responsible for your well-being. Anything's out there now. It used to be we could not have a TV, or we used to listen to radio. And I love radio drama, by the way. It's one of the most exciting things for me because it allows your imagination to work.
Sure.
But I really feel like when I made The Show that it's an outrageous subject matter. I was told by agents and managers people will love it or hate it, but I was trying to make a statement on our electronic society and on how we just follow along with each other.
Yeah.
And I think I was able to achieve that. You know, I make movies for between $3 and $5 million, which is, you know, it's a drop in the bucket. It's nothing. Yeah. So I have to take all of my resources and do everything I can in 20 days. And it's a lot of pressure, but I love it because I love working with people who are passionate and people, actors who really have chops to bring the story to life.
Yeah.
And because I'm an actor, they respect me a lot because I try to guide them. With Josh Duhamel, for example, I had to walk up to him second day on set. He's like, gee, do you really, is this? I said, look, I'm not going to let you fall. You gotta give up. You gotta just put yourself in my hands. Let me just guide you. It's not too much. It's right where it should be. You know, you're this funky Ryan Seacrest guy, but you have more morals, and it appears than he may. I don't know what his morals are, but yeah, as a character, you have more stuff in there. But you got to think, when those lights go on, you're that showman. And you get sucked in by this world that you know, really wanted to do something good, and then you weren't able to do that. So you become something else. And so it was a great example of how we change with power, with money.
Right.
And sometimes don't have the ability to be our best friend in those situations.
Why did you cast yourself in both of your movies?
Oh, you know what? I got to tell you the honest truth. You really want to know, because when you have a script and you got no money and you got no stars, so for me to put myself down means I've at least got a leg up. at least this dude is somebody. And my intention in both films, is a really great question, was to take myself out of the movie if I could find, then cast it with other actors, and then find an actor bigger than me who would carry more weight to take over my part. Now, twice that hasn't happened. And believe me, I've wanted it to happen. I want to direct a movie that I'm not in. I want to give all of my attention to directing. The Show I had to do. I had to do The Show. I had to play Mason Washington. I felt like I hadn't played a character who wasn't so smart, a working class guy, and who was losing his house and losing his family, because that was my life 7 years ago. I lost everything, 10 years ago now, everything, and including my marriage and my house, all the car, everything, wiped out. And so when I read this script, it came to me as I was sitting at my desk in my living room in Ridgefield, a week out of foreclosure, and I literally was thinking, my former wife worked for State Farm, I was going to take my life for the insurance policy. So, when this script came along, 3 days later, I cried crocodile tears, and I said, I got to make this movie. I got to play this character as well, because it'll be, it will heal me. to play this guy.
Therapeutic,
it'd be therapeutic. It'll put it behind me. It took me years after that to make the movie. On the same day, I got a book from a dear friend called Find the Cheese. So I said, so Dodge sends me a book, and he knows I'm in deep, deep trouble. I said, Dodge, you send me this little thin book about a mouse to try to find cheese. He said, just read it. Just read it. He says, just read the book. And I said, no, I can't even. I started reading the book, and it's about how men are hunter-gatherers. This little mouse is a hunter-gatherer. It's about how when the cheese source dries up, you find another one. It's such a simple little book, but it saved my life as well.
Simple works.
Wow. Simple works.
Simple works.
And cheaper than taking a Tony Robbins seminar.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Very good.
I want to know, when you were a kid and you wanted to do plays, how did that happen for you? What was it that you went, Mom and Dad, I want to go do – do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have a brother who did two shows. He did Maggie Flynn with me, and then he went on to do The Great White Hope with James Earl Jones. That's the first time I met Jimmy when I was very, very young. You know, everything in my life seems to come around somehow. My mother and father were divorced. We lived in a basement apartment in Yonkers, New York. They had been married for 11 years, and we were poor. Me, my brother, and my mother were sleeping in one bed. I can still remember the color of the food stamp coins. And my brother and I were watching Gigantor, which was an old comic that you may know. I don't know. You know, they were like Rock'em Sock'em Robots. They looked like Gigantor. On a Saturday morning, and the commercial came on. And we both were stunned by this commercial. And because it was probably the first time we saw, you know, a black kid on a commercial, which was so very rare. And then all of a sudden my eyes lit up and I said, Mommy, I have to help. We have to help. How do you do that? And I had sang in the church and my mother had been a church organist. I said, can you take us to an agent? Can we figure out how I can be available for commercial work? And so we went to an agent and I, 2 days later, got a call to go up for Maggie Flynn. I sang Happy Birthday. My agent was Ernestine McClendon. And I got it. And it all came out of necessity. Mm-hmm. It really came out of me wanting to help and figure out how to put food on the table. Alongside my mother, because we were just like didn't have it, and so once I hit that stage, and you know, back in Maggie Flynn, there were wenches. Like things got wenched on. They would wheel them on. They would wench two or three guys on each side, and this whole set would come out. A whole house would come out. A whole building would. God, I was just like the kid who was just like, oh, this is just like wow. It's like building blocks. You know, it's just
moving
like
scenery.
Moving scenery, things that come out of the floor and go up. I was just taken by it. And that all these elements could come together to make a seamless show that an audience would enjoy. And so as I started to hone my craft, I had a beautiful voice, which was nice. I realized more and more how much I enjoyed being someone who wasn't really me. Took me out of the pain of not having enough, of being treated a certain way. I found my complete persona, my complete self on that stage. And to me, you know, from Maggie Flynn to Lost in the Stars to Via Galactica to Seesaw with, oh my gosh, so many great folks in there, Michael Bennett.
Yeah,
Tommy Toon. Well, all of that formed me, and I realized I could find a place. It was like my meditation. That's how it started.
Yeah.
Wow. That's how it should be, though.
Yeah.
That is the magic of theater. That is the magic of performance.
Absolutely.
And it should be that deep, in its most utopian sense. It should speak to you, and it should enable you to express yourself and get the reward of that expression.
Absolutely.
And it has for you, which is just wonderful.
It's really worked.
Yeah. I grew up here. Both my parents are New Yorkers, and everyone in our family, we're a whole bunch of New York Jews, so everybody's over there. So that meant that I got to go and see Broadway as a kid. And I remember every single show my parents took me to. I remember all of them as a kid, every single one. And I can tell you everything about it. Because my dad's a compulsive credit reader in film. He taught me to do the same thing when reading playbills. So I would look at every single line of those playbills into the swing number 72. It didn't matter. And it stuck. It all stuck. And I remember everything. And that's theater.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If you don't get to see really brilliant theater, I'm, I, I will take you myself.
Yeah, like,
I will take you myself. There is just nothing.
But you have done it all. You've had the best of it because you've worked in television quite successfully. You've worked in movies. You're in a new movie, in fact.
Yes.
That opens today.
I sure am.
Lest we forget.
Yep. Wow, yes.
The Maze Runner.
Maze Runner.
The newest one, which is The Maze Runner, The Death Cure.
Yes, indeed.
And so you're being seen by a young audience.
Yes.
That may not know you from some of your other work.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, how this film came about is just an amazing thing. I was, you know, up in Canada doing Once Upon a Time, another television show, yep. Younger audience, and I got a call to come back down here and possibly meet with Wes Ball. I said, well, are they serious? I've got to get, and then no one's going to fly me in. You got to fly yourself. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't care about any of that. Tell me about this story. Okay, Maze Runner, based on 6 novels by James Dashner.
Yeah.
Young adult title. Okay, got all the info. Called my third daughter because I said I said something about this sounds familiar.
This is why you have kids.
I called Sear.
This is why you have kids.
She was 14 at that time. She's now 17. I said, Sear Lucia, let me ask you a question. Amazing. I've read all the books, Papa. They want you to play Jorge, don't they? Papa, you got to do this. I said, but I don't know it. Well, you better bone up quick. I said, so tell me about the story. She said, Jorge, he's with the kids. He's cool. He's this, he's that, he's the other. You got to go take this meeting. And they had been talking to me and another actor, and so I had to go win it in the meeting.
And you did.
I went and met with Wes Ball, and I just adored him as a director. He was so prepared. I liked the whole idea of it, and it all worked out. Jorge's fun, and he's a guy who can give you that strict look and that strict face. And, you know, where else would you have the opportunity to play like a space cowboy, like in a dystopian world who flies huge machines and yet who's erudite and who reads and who loves music? This character, I just pray that this third installment does so well this weekend that Wes Ball will give in as a director and say, yeah, I'll do the fourth because there's more material.
And then hire you back.
Exactly.
And then hire me back.
Now, keep your daughters very happy.
That's right.
That's it.
And there's a little lesson here too for young actors or for young people in the workplace that a man of your experience and all the years behind you and all the credits behind you was not unwilling to go and audition. Mm. You were willing to go and prove yourself to this filmmaker that he should hire you. And sometimes pride gets in the way of that kind of thing. And
for anyone.
For anyone.
For anybody.
I've been guilty of it.
Look, I've done my time, and I feel like you should know who I am. But look, I meet with filmmakers from Barcelona who know certain things and not others, and I meet from filmmakers all over the world, and I don't care. You know what I developed? I developed a healthy attitude toward it because I had an attitude for a while, too. Why should I go meet with him? He's seen my movies. No, he's still got to go in the room. Now, the opportunity to read or to meet is to be able to share my persona. And when I have to read, now I read and I say afterwards, thank you for the opportunity that you've given me to play today.
Ah.
Because I believe everything feeds the instrument.
Oh, man. That's it. That's it. You know what? We're going to go out on that.
Right.
Because I don't want to try to tap. That's such a nugget of wisdom that you've now given us all. And we thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we thank you for coming today, Giancarlo. It's been lovely meeting you and talking.
I want to see you on stage.
I would love that as well. That'll happen again. I have to say before I go, I've been a huge fan of yours for years.
Oh, well,
I mean that.
Thank you.
And I did not know you had this beautiful, lovely daughter as a partner, which has just put the icing on the cake. I really mean that. So thank you for having me. It's a blessing to be with you.
Thank you.
Are you a social media person?
I am.
Where can people find you?
You can find me at, social media, GiancarloEsposito.com. Giancarlo at GiancarloEsposito.com.
All right.
You can find me there.
Done.
Or the real Giancarlo Esposito.
Ooh, even better.
Even better.
I like that. I like that. And Jesse, remind people about us.
You are at Leonard. Remind them about us. Who are you again?
I don't remember.
You are at Leonard Maltin, and I am at Jesse Maltin on the Twitter and the Instagram. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and articles about fantastic movie books that have just come out and DVD releases of some really wonderful older films especially.
And such.
And such.
And we thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Take
Bye-bye.
Care, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.